Okay, continuing with Hirschsprung's disease. So in an infant, we look for a delayed passage of meconium in the first 24 to 48 hours, usually colicky, crying. Eventually, they don't tolerate oral intake because there's a backup of stool in the bowel, which makes it hard to take in more food. With an older kids, we're going to see abdominal distension as well. Could be intermittent because we will have, and you'll see progressive increasing of the abdominal distension. Again, anorexia because they become impacted and not able to take in more oral intake. We may see malnutrition because we've got obstruction. We've got diarrhea and leakage around the bowel obstruction. We've got problems with absorption, especially in that distal colon. Issues with dehydration and electrolyte imbalance can also be seen. Diagnosis of Hirschsprung's, we can do abdominal x-ray with or without contrast. We can see dilation of that bowel. But normally they'll want to use some barium as a contrast to be able to see the degree of dilation of the bowel and to really find the section of the colon that's affected. They can also do CT scan or MRI to visualize the portion of the bowel, but the definitive diagnosis is by rectal biopsy. And they actually take a biopsy of that segment of the colon and look under a microscope and see if there are ganglionic or aganglionic cells there. For treatment, the only possible treatment is bowel resection. They will go in and remove that affected portion of the bowel, give the patient a temporary colostomy while those ends of the bowel heal, while they treat for any bacterial infection in the abdominal cavity. Sometimes they even treat with antibiotics prior to surgery to decrease the risk of bacterial infection once they open the bowel up. And then they'll go back in and re-anastomose the two parts of the bowel after the bowel resection, after the temporary colostomy, take the colostomy down and re-anastomose the bowel. To prep for surgery, they're going to prep like they would with a colonoscopy. They're going to give clear liquids, do bowel prep with enema and laxatives to clear out the GI tract. Like I said, they'll do antibiotic therapy to decrease the normal bowel flora because even though it's normal bowel flora, if it's introduced into the abdominal cavity, they're at risk for peritonitis, abscess formation, and sepsis. So they want to decrease the amount of bacteria that will be free-floating when they cut into that bowel. Post-op, we want to make sure that we're keeping very close watch on their hydration status, their fluid and electrolyte status, as well as pain control. Assessing the stoma and teaching the family how to care for the stoma at home. They need to watch for skin breakdown. They need to watch for the type and the amount and the frequency and consistency of the stool that is obtained through the stoma. And they're going to be the ones that are maintaining the stoma at home until the re-anastomosis occurs. So we need to do anticipatory teaching, return demonstration, and really teach them how to care for that at home. Gastroesophageal reflux is the next disorder, and this is the backflowing of gastric contents into the esophagus. I know you've seen it a lot in your patients on MedSurg. With our patients on pediatrics, they just present a little bit differently. With the older kids, they will be able to tell you if they're presenting with heartburn or chest pain and things like that. With infants and young toddlers, they won't be able to do that. What happens is there's an incompetent lower esophageal sphincter that's at the end of the esophagus, the top of the stomach. So stomach contents, refluxes, and backflows up into the esophagus. It can be caused from increased intra-abdominal pressure pushing up and an incompetent lower sphincter. Either way, we've got stomach contents refluxing up into the esophagus, which then is in close proximity to the trachea, so the patient's at risk for aspiration. And if that stomach contents especially if it contains bile and stomach acids, can cause erosion of the trachea as well into the bronchi, into the bronchioles, and into the lungs. Signs and symptoms in the infant is recurrent spitting up. Okay, and when we talked about emesis earlier with acute vomiting, that's why it's important to understand the characteristics of what's coming back out. Is it just spitting up a regurgitation, or is it projectile vomiting? Is it undigested formula because it hasn't been in the stomach long enough? Is it in relation to feeds? Is it not in relation to feeds? That's why we need to know all of that information surrounding the emesis. Usually they're irritable because they're unable to tolerate enough formula to meet their metabolic needs, so they're hungry. They may have burning and irritation in their esophagus or their trachea. Recurrent respiratory tract infections. Weight loss and failure to thrive. Okay, in older children, they may be able to tell us that they're experiencing heartburn or chest pain. They may complain of abdominal pain. They may have dysphagia or difficulty swallowing, frequent burping, regurgitation, cough, and pneumonia. How do we diagnose it? Usually by barium swallow. We'll have the child drink a bottle or a cup and then watch for the regurgitation back up into the esophagus. How do we treat it? Medications, positioning, surgery. Okay, so the least invasive is to thicken the feedings with rice cereal. Give hypoallergenic formulas. Okay, we'll try the Nutramigen or Alimentum, something that's partially digested and hypoallergenic, not a lot of animal proteins and things like that in those formulas in case the regurgitation's happening because of an allergic response. Positioning, we're going to keep the kids upright or in semi-Fowler's position during and after feeds to decrease the risk of vomiting and aspiration. We may start medications. We may start H2 antagonists, the pepsids, the Reglans, Zantac, and Tagamet to help with decrease in acid production and to help speed things through the GI tract down the correct way to decrease the risk of regurgitation into the esophagus. Surgically, the procedure would be a Nissen fundoplication, which goes in and adjusts the stomach around the sphincter to close things off a little bit more. If we have a patient who's going to have a long-term permanent G-tube, then they may close that sphincter all the way off so that there's no chance of reflux. If it's a patient who may have short-term G-tube but will be reintroduced to oral intake at some point, then they may leave the sphincter a little bit open. But they want to close it enough to where the risk of aspiration is going to be decreased. Appendicitis is an inflammatory disorder that all of you have probably seen before, whether in your med-surg patients or pediatric patients already. And it's just an inflammation of the vermiform appendix that is on the small bowel, caused by bacterial infection or obstruction of that appendix, fecal material, particles from food, undigested food, nuts and seeds can get caught in that appendix, harbor bacteria, cause inflammation, cause swelling of the appendix, and can ultimately cause it to rupture, which can introduce fecal bacteria into the abdominal cavity. Can cause peritonitis, can cause abscess, can cause sepsis. So what are our signs and symptoms? Right lower quadrant pain is going to be the hallmark. Can also be periumbilical pain, kind of the whole abdomen not feeling great, but should localize to that right lower quadrant. Nausea and vomiting and anorexia are not uncommon. Diarrhea and or constipation, either or, depending on the patient. Rigid abdomen, sometimes it's rigid from peritonitis. Sometimes it's rigid from guarding. Rebound tenderness is one of the characteristics as well with appendicitis, meaning that the pain is there. When you press, the pain is relieved a little bit, and when you let go, the pain rebounds and returns. The pain is usually also progressive. Starts with mild abdominal pain, increases to severe pain. Other symptoms include fever, stooped posture because the standing up straight applies pressure and causes pain to the right lower quadrant, lethargy, usually from the nausea, vomiting, and anorexia. Diagnostically, they normally do a CBC to check for presence of infection and a differential to look at whether or not there's a bacterial or a viral indication. They also want to look at the patient's H&H and nutritional status prior to surgery. They can do an X-ray or an ultrasound of the abdomen to look for inflammation of the appendix. Treatment is going to be an appendectomy, whether it's an acute appendectomy that's done right away, or what they call an interval appendectomy, where they will treat the patient with antibiotics for 4 to 6 weeks. The rationale being the same for with Hirschsprung's disease, decreasing the amount of bacteria in the GI tract so that when they go to do surgery, there's less to be introduced into the abdominal cavity. Another structural defect, craniofacial abnormalities of cleft lip and cleft palate. They can occur separately or together. So a patient can have a cleft lip with no cleft palate, or a cleft palate with no cleft lip, or both. And it can be unilateral or bilateral. Remember back to OB when we're talking about fetal development. Everything starts as a neural tube and works its way forward in fetal development to connect in the front. So with cleft lip and cleft palate, there's a problem in the connection in fetal development. Associated problems include problems with difficulties feeding, upper respiratory tract infections. You've got an open passage, especially with cleft palate, through the sinuses into the ear canals. So you'll have problems with otitis media, speech problems, problems with dental formation because the gums are also affected if you have issues with cleft palate, and self-image as the patients become older. With cleft lip and cleft palate, one of the things that we worry about is interference with bonding of the parents because of the abnormality in the child, especially if they didn't know during prenatal care or didn't get prenatal care that the child was going to be born with cleft lip or cleft palate. If you have parents that don't bond with their child, you also have parents who run the risk of not attending to their child appropriately for their needs. Some feeding techniques with a child with cleft lip. Feeding more upright to avoid aspiration, frequent burping, that way we decrease the risk of emesis that could lead to aspiration, use of a lamb's nipple, which is an extra long nipple that goes back into the patient's esophagus so that they don't have to just rely on the tongue and palate and lips for a suck swallow. An aseptic syringe with tubing if the infant is unable to create closure and suction. So they may syringe and tube feed, NG and OG feed, or use the aseptic syringe, which looks kind of like a turkey baster, to get the formula into the patient's mouth. Surgical repair of the cleft lip usually happens between 2 to 4 months of age. And they wait because it decreases the surgical risks for the patient. And the child is a little bit older, then the risk of complications from anesthesia and surgery are decreased. Post-op care includes prevention of strain on the suture line, which means we're going to keep the infants off of their stomach because of the increased dependent pressure. And we want to make sure that they're not pulling on or tugging on or scratching their suture line, so it may require elbow or wrist restraints or papoose restraints or sedation. We need to make sure that we're keeping the suture lines clean. We can apply an antibiotic ointment, rinse with normal saline, and clean with Q-tips carefully. With cleft palate, the feeding techniques are the same. We're going to be using the specialty nipples and feeding devices, keeping the patient upright, thickening the liquids as soon as possible to help keep them down and decrease the risk of aspiration because of that open cavity in the mouth to the sinuses and the ear canals. Aspiration can be a problem. Frequent upper respiratory tract and ear infections are common. With cleft palate, surgical repair is usually delayed until 9 to 18 months of age. They try to perform closure prior to speech development so that the child can develop speech as normally as possible after repair. The surgical repair is never just done with one surgery. It's usually progressive surgeries with follow-up and grafting until the patient is done. And they still may have revisions throughout life if necessary. Normally, they wait until after the patient is weaned to a cup and no longer depending on a suck, swallow, for nutrition because that can put extra strain on the suture line and the palate. Post-op care, keep on abdomen until fully awake. This is different from the cleft lip. There's not as much dependent stress that we need to worry about. We need to worry more about the aspiration. Semi-liquid to pureed diet. This patient in the picture, the cleft lip is usually corrected before the cleft palate. Patient may require elbow or wrist restraints to keep them from pulling on or messing with the suture lines. Again, keeping the suture lines clean is important to decrease risk of infection. Long-term complications, even after surgical repair, can be problems with speech. Long-term dental issues can be a problem, and psychosocial issues with body image and self-image. Another obstructive disorder is intussusception. Intussusception is a telescoping of a portion of the small intestine or colon into a more distal segment, meaning that part of the bowel telescopes or invaginates back up into another portion of the bowel. For example, if you had a rubber glove from the hospital and you blew it up like a balloon and took one of the fingers and pushed it back into the hand of the glove, that invagination, that telescoping back in, is what happens to the bowels with intussusception. Signs and symptoms on assessment. The patient usually presents with vomiting. Again, you've got an obstruction, like with Hirschsprung. So you've got an area where bowel contents isn't moving. They'll have pain, paroxysmal, colicky abdominal pain that comes and goes. Characteristic current jelly stools, where you've got blood and mucus mixed in with usually a more liquidy kind of stool, and it literally looks like a rust color jelly in the diaper. So it's pretty characteristic for intussusception. Diagnosis is done with x-ray and a barium enema with contrast on fluoroscopy for that x-ray. They use barium enemas with intussusception for a variety of reasons. One is for diagnostic purposes, and also to try to help reduce and treat the intussusception. Sometimes with the barium enema, they can force the telescoping part of the bowel to undo itself with the barium enema. If they can reduce it that way, then the patient avoids having surgery. If it doesn't work, then they have to go in and surgically undo the bowel in that section. They don't necessarily resect unless there has been ischemia that happens, because when you have that invagination, you have an impaired circulation in that area also. So a patient with intussusception is a surgical emergency. If they don't get in and untelescope that portion of bowel can become ischemic and necrotic and can die and can cause sepsis for the patient, as well as leakage of all of the abdominal bacteria or GI bacteria into the abdominal cavity. So intussusception is a surgical emergency. We would need to take care of that right away before that segment of the bowel dies. Normally, once it's been surgically corrected, it doesn't happen again. Doesn't mean that it can't, but the likelihood is very small. Post-op care, we need to worry about gastric decompression. Normally, they'll come back from surgery with an NG tube. We'll let the gut rest for a while and then slowly start reintroducing food and fluids, meaning we start with clear liquids, move to full liquids, soft foods, and eventually to a regular diet. We're also going to supplement with IV therapy to maintain hydration and electrolyte balance. Another obstructive disorder is pyloric stenosis. With GERD, we were worrying about the esophageal sphincter at the top of the stomach. With pyloric stenosis, we're dealing with the pyloric valve at the bottom of the stomach that goes into the small intestine. What happens is that valve becomes hypertrophied with excess musculature there or scar tissue. It's an idiopathic problem. There's not any particular thing that causes it. Signs and symptoms are going to be that projectile vomiting, and it's because of the force of the pressure in the stomach. The baby feeds and feeds and feeds because they're hungry. They're not absorbing much because that valve, the outlet of that valve, is so tiny and constricted that not much food is passing through to the small intestine. So not much is being absorbed into the body, so they're hungry, and they'll suck it down, and then the pressure builds up in the stomach, and it shoots back out through the esophagus and projectile vomits. You can see visible peristaltic waves. Those guts want to be processing something. If they're processing anything, it's small amounts of formula that's passing through that valve. You may be able to palpate an olive-sized mass in the right upper quadrant where that hypertrophied muscle is. The babies usually are very irritable because they're hungry, and they'll readily accept feeding after they vomit because they're still hungry. They don't have pain. It's not like they have an inflammatory process going on. It's a structural problem. So they're still hungry, and they'll still eat, even though nothing may pass through. How do we diagnose it? We do barium swallow. So they'll put barium into a bottle, have the baby drink it down, and watch through that valve how much goes through the outlet. Normally when a patient comes back from a barium swallow, we insert an NG or an OG tube and we rinse that gut out, because if the patient doesn't projectile vomit it out, that barium is going to sit in that stomach, not be able to pass through, and becomes like cement in there. Problems with pyloric stenosis, and because of the excessive projectile vomiting, is dehydration and electrolyte imbalance, alkalosis, and malnutrition. Our top concerns are restoring that fluid and electrolyte balance. The malnutrition, normally we see pyloric stenosis in infants because as their feed volumes increase, the pressure in their stomach is going to increase, and if that outlet is too small, it's just going to start coming back out. So normally they'll seek care for excessive vomiting in that early infancy period. Correction is by surgical correction and a pyloromyotomy, where they put a small incision above where that pyloric valve is, and they go in and either digitally expand the valve with a finger, kind of stretch the musculature out, break down that tissue, or they may use like a balloon stent like they do with an angiogram or angioplasty, where they go in, insert the little balloon, dilate that valve, and remove the balloon. Post-op, we're again worried about fluid and electrolyte status because we want to make sure that the patient's going to be able to tolerate what we're putting in. The feeding schedule is very strict, and it starts out very conservatively, like 5, 10, 15 mLs of Pedialyte, given once an hour for a couple of hours until we know that the patient's going to tolerate that. Then we may increase the volume a little bit. We may increase the consistency to a diluted formula until the patient works their way up to a normal consistency formula and a normal volume. Remember that gut has been pretty spasmodic as it's been filled and puked and filled and puked, so we want to make sure that the patient's tolerating before we send them home, or we run the risk of having the fluid and electrolyte imbalance. I know the slide says sterile water. We do not use sterile water, and critically thinking, sterile water is only going to dilute the electrolytes more in the body, so we use Pedialyte. When we're assessing nutrition and fluid balance needs, again, the things that we've talked about before, daily weights, I's and O's, assessing for signs and symptoms of dehydration, maintain IV therapy if the patient's not meeting their needs orally, give oral care if the patient's NPO, monitor those labs and those electrolytes for kidney function and fluid and electrolyte status. When we're reintroducing foods, we start small. Okay, we start clear, we start small, and then we increase as we can. Monitor for vomiting and diarrhea and abdominal distension. Monitor their toleration. With nutrition status, again, we want to check for any vomiting, assess their tolerance to their feedings, graph their weights and their heights so that we can see how they compare. Thicken feedings when necessary and as appropriate for GERD or for cleft lip or palate. Feed slowly. We want to assess, again, from the mouth to the anus. Check their suck. Check how their gut responds to what their feedings are. Give small amounts frequently if necessary. Count calories. Sit the infant upright in an infant seat if nobody's available to hold them upright after feeding. What are some of our nursing care and concerns for each of these? With cleft lip and cleft palate, and a diagnosis of high risk for infection for the different disorders, upper respiratory tract infections and otitis media, or the high risk infections for cleft lip and cleft palate, risk of spread of infection for patients with diarrhea. The body may be debilitated with pyloric stenosis to where they can't fight off infection because of their difficulty with fluid and electrolyte and nutrition status. And with appendicitis, they're going to be at risk for peritonitis and abscess formation post-surgery or post-rupture. With the risk of infection, we've got superficial or internal and systemic infections. With a superficial infection, we're looking at the incision sites for redness, heat, swelling, tenderness, pain, any drainage. With a systemic infection, the incision itself might look fine, but the patient has increase in abdominal pain, where we would expect that pain to be decreasing. Increase in abdominal girth, a guarding of the area that we would expect to be decreasing as the patient's getting better, and fever that is uncontrolled. With knowledge deficit, we need to assess the parent's understanding of the child's needs and the problem. Okay, what is the problem that we have identified? How are we treating it? What is going to be the follow-up care? What is going to be their responsibility as far as home care? We need to assess the parent's ability to learn. Can we just hand them a pamphlet and they read it? Do we need to draw pictures? Do we need to print pictures off of the internet? Do we need to pull information from textbooks? Okay, we need to teach simply and clearly and allow them time for questions and return demonstration. If the parents are going to be expected to do packing and dressing changes at home or stoma care or use particular feeding devices and feeding techniques, we need to make sure that they understand what those are and that we teach them and let them return demonstrate so that we can answer any questions or correct any problems. If they're going to need support groups or referrals for speech therapy, for instance, for cleft lip or cleft palate, make sure that we start instituting those and at least talking to the family about those ahead of time. The last few slides of this PowerPoint are a case study that I am going to let you guys discuss in class along with the other case studies that Meg has available for you. This one is about Jesus, who is 5 years old with suspected appendicitis. So this case study is something that you guys can read over and discuss in class.